Today we have the good fortune of having His Holiness Hanumanta Abhishek Maharaj in our midst. Maharaj has been a devotee in ISKCON since 1974, and he took sannyas in 1984, started initiating disciples in 1994, and he has been traveling extensively since 2004.
Hold the microphone a little lower, otherwise okay. You're getting... Hold the microphone just below, otherwise you get pop, pop, pop.
Yes, Maharaj. Is this better?
Yeah.
Okay. So Maharaj has been, the last few years has been emphasizing on education within ISKCON, and he has been participating in so many activities to push for that particular cause. And he is a great instructor, and the speciality of Maharaj is he makes things very simple, even the complex topics. He breaks it down in very easily understandable way. So we are very glad to have His Holiness Hanumanta Abhishek Swami Maharaj in our midst. And let's just welcome him by saying, Hari Bol!
Hari Bol!
Okay. Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. I pay him $75 a month. he wanted more, but... So we're doing Bhagavad Gita, no? Okay. Sarva Veda Sar. Oma Gyana Tamirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Word by word translation there. What does the word Om mean?
Krishna.
It means Krishna. Oh, fanatic. Huh?
Huh? He says, I'm the sound of Om.
Yeah. It's hard to define, actually. Yeah. One place Jiva Goswami says there are three syllables, ah, oo, ah. And they mean Radha, Krishna, and Jiva. Prabhupada says it's the impersonal form of address. Like if, for example, I'd say, oh, did you hear the president's coming? The president's coming to San Jose at 5 o'clock today. You say, oh, Obama's coming here? You say, yeah, yeah. So the president, you know, it's the impersonal form of address for, you know, Mr. Barack Obama. So Om is the impersonal address for Bhagavan, for Krishna, like that. Yeah. Agyana, what is Agyana?
Ignorance.
Om Agyana. Timirandhasya. Yeah? And blind also? Blindness? Anda? Om Agyana Timirandhasya. Gyananjana? Yeah, anjana means ointment, no? Is it? Anjana ointment? Yeah. Gyan anjana shalakaya. Shalaka means the instrument for applying it. Yeah, it means like that. Yeah. Gyananjana shalakaya. Chakshur unmilitam jina tasmai shri gurave namaha. It's a very nice prayer. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master has opened my eyes with a torch of knowledge. I offer my obeisances to him. And then Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Srivats Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. And by the mercy of the interaction of these five acharyas, we can become freed from our offenses, and then we can chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And nothing else needs to be said. Krishna consciousness is like nectar on the tongue of a speech-impaired person. Krishna consciousness is like nectar on the tongue of a dumb man. He smiles and smiles and doesn't say anything. Yeah. So I heard you're just finishing chapter 3? No, chapter 3. 3? No. Just finishing. Yeah. And so somebody was suggesting we're supposed to do like a summary or something. So in general, Bhagavad Gita, how many chapters in Bhagavad Gita? Okay. Yeah. And the first chapter is what? That's the title. But what happens there? What happens in the first chapter? Bhagavad Gita, what happens? It's very important.
Arjuna is in the battlefield, and he basically the entire scene of Mahabharata is explained by
Prabhupada.
No, of course, yes, but through the so Dhritarashtra is actually hearing the entire scene of what's happening on the field of Mahabharata through the eyes through the words of Sanjaya, and the scene is set, and Arjuna is ready on the battlefield, but he is not ready to fight the enemies. So Sanjaya is just explaining what is going on in his mind and what's the conversation that's going on between Lord Krishna and Arjuna.
By the mercy of Vyasa, Sanjaya's spiritual master, not only could he see everything and hear everything, but he could also understand what people were thinking, you know, like that. So in the beginning, probably gives a whole explanation, because ideas, you've read the whole Mahabharata before this, and you know all these things, who's everybody. So Prabhupada gives the purports, he gives a little commentary. But I would say that in the beginning, Arjuna is approaching the situation as a karmi. Yeah, he's time to get righteous revenge. There's always new movies every year, there's new movies, you know, but there's always every year a few new revenge movies. Like the poor housewife who suffers this and that from her children, her husband, her in-laws, her employer. And finally, at the end of the movie, she gets revenge like that. Ha, ha, ha. You know? Or the teacher who's being harassed by his students. Or so there's vachovegam manasa, krodavegam. Anger is a big push, you know. So Arjuna's been angry for so long, and Bhima's even more angry. Oh, boy, Bhima's so happy. He's just sitting there, hitting the ground with his club, the whole ground is shaking. He's looking over at Duryodhana, you know, slapping his thighs, you know. Oh, so that's the whole scene to start with. Is that they're all thinking about gratification, you know, and you know Arjuna wants to satisfy Draupadi. He wants to satisfy, you know, his older brother has been insulted. You know, good guy, you know. So in the beginning, Arjuna's a karmi. You know, he doesn't want to break any rules. He was going to, now by Yudhisthira's mercy, we're going to enjoy, and nobody can criticize us. Nobody can criticize us for what we've done. You know, we have a right to enjoy. Yeah. So it's karmi, you know. So then he tells Krishna, what's the Sanskrit here? He tells Krishna, Sinayor Ubayor Maye. Put the chariot in front of. Yeah. So I can. Yeah. Put the chariot in front of the opposing parties, so I can see who has come here to oppose us, bent on satisfying the evil-minded son of Dhritarashtra. You know. So Chris is hearing all this. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Baba, let's try this. You know. So he puts him right in front of Duryodhana. No. Doesn't put him in front of Duryodhana. Puts him in front of. No. Yeah, and that he's Diksha Guru. He's representing Madan Mohan. Take us away from Madan, right? That's Diksha Guru. So he's taking Arjuna away from Maya. Okay, all this enjoyment, but you're not looking at the whole picture, Baba. You know, Drona's going to die. Yeah, Bhishma's going to die, and they never did anything bad to him, right? He loves him more than anything, you know. And then, okay, all your nephews are going to die, you know. Big, brave hero, kill your nephews, you know. What can they do against you? Oh, and all your cousins, you know. You may not like them, they may not be good people, but they're your cousins, like that. And so, well, Prabhupada says, actually, you can't understand Bhagavad Gita, you're so impersonal now. He's like that, you know. So then the first chapter is the problem. We got it here. Okay. There it is. Observing the armies. Can't do this with a web page, with a soft copy. How much is it? Here's the first chapter. Okay. That much. Okay. This, pretty much a little more, is the problem. Okay? Yeah. This, my God, is the solution. Yeah. It's like, yeah, yeah. But without understanding the problem, then the whole solution doesn't make much sense in some ways. Yeah. So Arjuna is not a bad person. Krishna is not preaching to a Bhikarmi. Krishna is preaching to a Karmi. And right away, he brings him out of this thing of enjoyment. Practically speaking, from that point on, as far as I know, only one point does Krishna ever even talk about enjoying this world. He's suggesting it to Arjuna. You know, he suggests it, and Arjuna just forgets it. You know, I'm finished with that. You know, so then Arjuna, makes a suggestion how to solve the problem. What is Arjuna's suggestion about how to solve the problem? He doesn't want to kill all of his cousins, everything else. What's he do?
It's better to live by
vengeance. Yeah, just to walk away from the whole thing. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler to take arms against a sea of Kauravas and by opposing end them, or to die, to sleep, yeah, perchance to dream. Ah, but there's the rub. For who knows what dreams may come after we have shuffled off this mortal coil. And so the native hue of resolution is sicklied over with a paler cast of thought. Yeah. And conscience does make, introspection, does make cowards of us all. Yeah. It's the same problem, identical. We have a whole PowerPoint show, it's one awards, you know, Hamlet and Arjuna. These are the two most famous books in the world, Hamlet and Arjuna. Same problem, same thing, you know. Because he's going to go, oh, Govinda, second chapter. Krishna says you should fight, if you don't fight, all the girls will laugh at you and you'll be dishonored by your enemies. And for one who has been honored, death is worse than one than dishonor. Yeah, and if you win, what'll happen, huh? You enjoy the kingdom, and if you lose, go to heaven. So basically, here he's preaching karmakanda, saying, do your duty, and come on, because if you lose, you're going to go to heaven, and if you lose, you're going to go to heaven. If you win, you're going to, ride on the big elephant, and all the little girls will throw flowers in front of you and say, Jai Jai Arjuna, Arjuna. Okay, so come on, let's go. And that's the point I was talking about. That's karmakanda. But Arjuna doesn't, not satisfied. He was a good man. That's the point. He was a good man. In fact, he was a little bit too good. That's the problem. Yeah. So then he says, oh, Govinda, all these suggestions. And then he says, oh, Govinda, I shall not fight. Yeah. But before that, this is super essential, then one verse there which changes the whole thing, what happens? He's not going to fight, but he makes. I can't satisfy this thing by becoming a renunciate. I can't fight. Then what does he do? Huh? Uh huh. What verse is that? Huh? Huh? 2.7. I was thinking. My mind was saying 2:47, but I knew it was impossible. Okay. So basically, if you know, it's roughly in the beginning of the second chapter. Okay, you can find it then pretty quick, Yeah. And of course, the last, that's not 2.7. Well, yeah, it is. So the very last line is enough, I think, to memorize. Sisyas te hum sadimam te prapanam. Okay, what does sisyas te hum mean?
I'm your student.
Sadimam. Instruct me. Sisyas te hum sadimam. I'm surrendered unto you. So three things. What are the three things? Yeah. Before that, the first thing probably is going backwards. I'm surrendered. Yeah. I'm your student. Please instruct me. Yeah. And then that's Dhritarashtra is happy. Arjuna is not going to fight. Oh, goody goody. But then Sanjaya says, "But Maharaj, it's just a matter of time." Yeah. Ravana kidnapped Sita, and she was crying. The demigods were afraid to help her. Everybody, she was crying out, "Ram, Lakshman," and it was so terrible. That the whole universe was going off its axis because her crying was so intense like that. It was so terrible, and all the animals and trees were saying, "There is no gentleness. There is no mercy." It was incredible, and everybody's really unhappy, terribly unhappy. Then Brahma's unhappy, and he says, yes, but he says, but our purpose is accomplished. Ravana is a dead man. So same way, is that, you know, he's telling him, you can be very happy for a couple seconds, but forget it. Arjuna's going to fight. He surrendered to Krishna. He's accepting him as authority. And so all of his illusions are going to be destroyed. You know, and it'll just be a matter of time. So that's it. Then Krishna starts giving his instructions. And what is the first thing he teach? In big 30 verses he teaches? Sankhya. Let's just analyze the situation. That's very interesting. He starts with Sankhya. He starts to calm down. Let's just look at things in a proper perspective. You know, this belongs here, that belongs here, that belongs here. You go after the Sunday feast to wash the pots in the kitchen. You put all the spoons in one pile, put the big pots over here, clean the sink up, get that ready, get the detergent. Okay, Sankhya. Now what's next? Statics and then? Statics and? Dynamics, yeah. So the second half of chapter 2 is? What's it called? What's it titled? Buddhi Yoga. Yeah, Buddhi Yoga. Yeah. And one verse is the essence. What is it, 247? Yeah. Because he's glorifying. He's saying Buddhi Yoga is really great. If you don't follow Buddhi Yoga, you'll go to hell. The essence of everything is that. Yeah, so 247, as far as I understand, that's what is Buddhi Yoga. And what is Buddhi Yoga? Karmani eva dikaraste ma paleshu kadachana ma karma pala hetu bur ma te sangha swakarmani. We got three ma's there. What does ma mean? Yeah? Dardwaja mat ban karo. I'm learning Hindi. Dardwaja mat ban karo. Yeah. Don't close the door. Yeah. Ma. So, number one, karmani eva adhikaraste. Adhikari is a word. Authorized. Karmani eva adhikaraste. You're authorized to do your duty. But, ma paleshu, not the fruit, ma karma pala hetur. Hetu?
Cause.
Yeah, don't think you're the cause. There are thousands and millions of bacteria, insects, frogs, dogs, everything else combining to make this world work. You think you're the cause of all these things. Mate sangosvi akarmani. Akarmani. And don't be attached to not doing your duty. And that's kind of Arjuna's first proposition. You know, Prabhupada says one should not forget to become angry to drive away the wrongdoers, at least for some time. So devotees' tendency many times, that's the whole thing, is just to back off, go away, not want to fight, you know. But then that's a contamination, because no? Then you should. Violence is never good, but it's sometimes necessary to defend the weak against the strong when good arguments fail. It's kind of like, okay, you know, it's never good. I had to give a lecture to like 65 police officers in Peru. They're like Secret Service guys, guard the president, everything else. They all had like square necks, short haircuts, and about like, 38 of them and about 7 police women, identical purses, all sitting like that. I came in for the class, they're all sitting like this by their desks, you know. And the ladies rolled their purses by their desks, you know. And they came in. Then the devotee's father, he was the chief of the secret police in Peru, he walked in the office, stood up like that. Ladies, gentlemen, he sat down, you know. This guy's going to tell you about this and that and everything else. And they all sat there listening, you know, like that, you know. And they was talking about Varna Ashram police. And they sat, and so I. And the questions afterwards, one of them was that, if you kill somebody during the whole line of duty and everything else, do you get some karma for that? And I was saying this, it's never good, you know, violence, but sometimes it's necessary, you know, to defend the weak against the strong when good arguments fail. So I said, you'll always feel bad about it. And I was watching, and about 5 people in the audience were all kind of going like, you know, they've gone through it. Yeah, you just don't feel good, you know, you know. So yeah, but sometimes that's where we're going beyond the mode of goodness, because we're giving up the mode of goodness and doing something even though it's so bad. But we know we had to do it. Yeah, like that. Okay, so this is 247. What is it? But the problem with this is what? What's missing here? You have a right to. Many people think this is the whole essence of Bhagavad Gita. I know one school, they printed this on our bags. All our students and teachers walked around with this verse on it. And many people think this is the essence. You have a right to perform your prescribed duty. You have not a right to the fruit. Don't think of the cause of the action, and don't be attached to not doing your duty. What's wrong with that?
Want to know the result.
Huh?
It is not yet connected to Krishna.
There's nobody to enjoy it. Yeah, we all want to love somebody, please somebody, like that. So then I would say 3:30, to my mind, is pretty much the first place. Mat Para appears before this, but 3:30 is very clear. I think it's the first place in the Bhagavad Gita where, and Bhakti Prabhupada said, the whole essence of the Bhagavad Gita is here. Sanskrit is so simple, no? Mai sarvani karmani sanyasyadyatmachetasa nirasir nirmamo bhutva yujashva vigato jvara. And especially the first line, mai sarvani karmani. And this chapter is called, what's the title of this chapter? It is finished? Yeah. So what is the difference between karma and dharma? Kshatriya dharma and kshatriya karma.
Dharma is a natural position, or a position to take action. Karma is just a place where that is going to happen, when action is kind of a choice. Dharma is a separate individual thing, but karma is kind of a field of
activities. Okay. Anybody else? Yeah.
The distinction between right principles and right action.
Okay. I agree, yeah, but it's there's kshatriya dharma and kshatriya karma, like that, yeah. And so dharma is more like, you know, your nature, your activities, and karma, what you're doing. But it's almost the same thing, you know. See, his chapter, the word karma appears so many times, right, in this chapter, like that. You have, therefore, Arjuna, surrender all your works unto me. You know, so Sanskrit is very clear. Mai sarvani karmani, very clear. It's the first time, I think, that as far as I know, the whole Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is really saying, you know, do it for me. Earlier there's a verse which says, mat para. This is more like activities in terms of me or something, but there's no like idea of really, you know, just in perspective of me. But now it's just, do your karma, do your dharma, do your, was it mat karma paleshu, karma adhakari, do it for me. Yeah, so, yeah. Yeah, there were, it's integrated like that. Again, it's more like the static and the dynamic, you know. Yeah. And he's describing it that way. You know, all living entities subsist upon food grains. And food grains come from? And rain comes from? The sacrifice comes from? Prescribed duties. And prescribed duties are mentioned in the Vedas. Yeah. So, Prabhupada says in the second chapter, it's not very clear. I was thinking that way. Oh, it's not very clear. That's kind of offensive to think that way. But Prabhupada says, no, it's not very clear. So Arjuna can't take any practical action. And he makes this point. How does the third chapter begin? Wait a second. Think about it. Okay. How does the third chapter begin? Yeah? And what does Arjuna say? Yeah.
On the other hand,
yeah. Don't be engaged in stupid activities like that. Don't create karma. Don't be involved in karma. You understand? Yeah. Okay, let's go fight. And that's, yes, it's a very subtle point. For me, I understood this as soon as I heard this. It was like one lecture by one hippie guru. What was his name? Who was in charge of the hog farm. What was his name? He's kind of a famous guy. The hog farm was his place. He's a traveling guy. But his explanation of it was, akarma is like taking a full swing on a golf ball in a tile bathroom and hitting the window. Because if you don't hit the window, it's going to get you. You know, it's going to bounce off and eventually hit you. It's like, you know, full swing with a golf ball. You know, it was like an idiot. You know, it's like that. You know? But if you go through the window, okay. So that was his explanation, is you can do, you have to do your activity, but you got, he didn't have Krishna very clear. Stephen something, you know. Pretty famous guy. You know. So that's the whole point, is Arjuna's, Krishna trying to communicate this point to Arjuna. It's a certain level. And the Bhagavad Gita is not very advanced. Many people are expecting big things from Bhagavad Gita, so they become frustrated. No, Bhagavad Gita is basically the ABCs. But it's good to have your ABCs down, right? Like that. You go over them again and again, like that. So basically it's for somebody who's coming from the level of being a jnani to a yogi. Right? But now a karma yogi. Yeah. Here it is.
So this question will crop up, that if Bhagavad Gita is just the ABC, then two questions is that, why do I read it in the first place? Because I'm looking for, like, you know, higher tastes, quote unquote. The second thing is, Maharaj, it's said that the Bhagavad Gita is complete book in itself. And so where is prema, and where you talk of prema bhakti, where is it mentioned in Bhagavad Gita? Two questions.
He says Bhagavad Gita is complete and sufficient in itself for liberation. I mean, I've heard this different ways, that ways, and finally in our readings, I keep my own notes, I have it written down now. Prabhupada says, Bhagavad Gita is the cultivation of the intellect, and the cultivation of the soul starts in Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's for liberation, you know. Krishna is described as ultimately as the Paramatma. He who knows everything. He who is the source of everything. He who is every, you know. There's not much. There's no rasa was it described in there. I'm describing that. You know. But again, everything is here. So again, he shows the Virat Rup. He shows the forearm form. Then he shows Somyavapu, a very beautiful form. But it doesn't talk about it at all. But you know, the most natural thing is to understand that Shyamasundar, because he's already showed the universal form, he showed the forearm form. So then, you know, anybody with, you know, as it is, it's a forearm form, the two-arm form he's talking about. No, that's the impersonal Brahman. Yeah.
Can you use the mic?
They're
Can you use the mic?
It's on television here. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I better be careful.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't talk too loud. Yeah, the point I was going to say, but there is really an important implication. He might say it's implied. There is a bhakti element here that is implied, and that is the friendship that is developed between Arjuna and Krishna, especially on the battlefield. You know, that closeness, that proximity one to the other.
Yeah.
So, and that trust. So really the first fruits of bhakti are sowed here.
Yeah.
You know, servitorship and friendship. You know, at last I understand I can trust you, and I just put it all in your hands, just surrender to me. You know, that's the beginning of the whole story right there. You're ready to move on.
Prabhupada says you can't understand Bhagavad Gita unless you worship the deity. So that's the point. But some of that more comes out in other parts of the Mahabharata. Other parts of the Mahabharata, there's more like these emotional relationships and stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. Some points, you know, very emotional. Yeah. So chapter 3, it starts off with this, pass the microphone. There's two, there's three.
Before we leave chapter 2,
just
go over one verse, just to know your feedback on that.
Okay.
And that is 245.
Oh, okay.
Where Krishna is saying, the Vedas deal mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. O Arjun, become transcendental to these three modes. Be free from all dualities and from all anxieties for gain and safety, and be established in the self. So what is Krishna implying when he's saying, be established in the self?
Atmaman. I don't know exactly, but I think it's the first part. He's talked about, you know, the Atma, and the Atma is different than other Atmas, and the Atma is different than matter, the body. That's basically all the Sankhya we get in the first part. Later on, talk about the five great elements, all these things, you know. But the Sankhya he gives us in the first part is just that the Atma is different than the dehinoshmin yata dehe komaram yobanam jarate dehantara praptir diras tattva namavite. So if he's used the word atma or not, I don't know. You know, if he's already used the word atma and explained it and given some reference like that. But that's what, at least what he's talked about, is don't get caught up in the action and reaction of changing heat and cold, honor and dishonor, profit and gain, which all are being produced by in terms of the body. Be fixed in the Atma, like that. How's it go? The very first thing he says, Pragnyavadam Shabasya se Gatasum Zagatasum Sa Nanu Socha Lipanditaha. Sochayana vasochastvams, pragnams vadav. It's the very first instructions, yeah. Yeah. So that's the question. It's a nice question. And is he actually given some reference before to Atma specifically? Because he's talking about, he must have, he's a self. That's the thing he's referring to, like that point. But there's not much detail, you know. But for many people, it's a big surprise. You know, it's the whole thing. They never thought they weren't the body, you know. It's like a big surprise. Yeah. I will also turn off my cell phone at this point. We will now have a brief break to turn off our cell phones. Okay. Push the button. Okay, our break is over. Yeah.
So you must be referring to the higher self, which is the soul, rather than the mind or the body.
We had a discussion in Peru with Professor Miguel Polo. He's the head of the Department of Philosophy at San Marcos University. So he's a Buddha. He likes Buddhism. He's a professor, so he studies it like academically, but he likes it too. He also likes devotees, you know. So we had a kind of like a debate on part of one of our big programs like that. And I was, Bhaktivinoda Thakur's point of criticizing Buddhism, you know. And this is the whole thing. And so finally he said, you know, cause he knows contemporary Buddhism and everything else. He said, okay, this much I will say is a certain fact, that 90% of the groups of Buddhists in the world, when they say there is no Atma, they're referring to the mind. They never even consider like a self like that. They're saying the mind, it does not exist permanently. And so the word Atma, Prabhupada says, can mean action, endeavor, body, or mind, or self. I think those four things. But usually, it's referring to the self as different from the other ones like that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I had a question actually with respect to Bhakti Yoga itself. Yeah. Until verse 330, Lord Krishna doesn't reveal himself as the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Very good.
And before that itself, Lord Arjuna actually surrenders himself to Lord Krishna. Is that because he was indecisive about what to do, or was it Bhakti Yoga that made him surrender himself to Krishna?
Prabhupada says, Arjuna became confused about who Krishna was, who he was, by Krishna's arrangement. Yeah. But at heart, he never ceased to love Krishna. Yeah. So sometimes it's just like you're doing something, you just like do it because you know it's right, but your mind, you can't rationalize it or everything else. So what his actual consciousness was at that moment. But fundamentally, he knew who Krishna was and everything else. You know, because why? You know, that's the point is that Prabhupada makes that point. What's the use of taking Krishna's words serious if he's just a politician in some battlefield, you know? And why would Arjuna surrender to him? You know, so there's already some kind. That's the whole point about the problem with the yoga ladder, is that it's all yoga. And so whether it's karma yoga or bhakti yoga, it's confusing sometimes because it's all yoga. And so ultimately, the only yoga is bhakti yoga, you know? And so from the very beginning, there has to be some kind of idea of what the goal is, you know, like that. But in karma yoga, it's more, you're more focusing on doing something. The next level, jnana yoga, you're more focused on, like right now, getting the ideas straightened out, develop your intelligence, your perspective. And in dhyana yoga, you're more concerned with actually taking a very scrutinizing look at Krishna. And then in bhakti, pure bhakti yoga, then you're concerned about changing your motivation, you know, purifying your motive, like that.
Yeah. Is Jnana Yoga and Sankhya Yoga, they are the same terms?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. And yogas and Jnana Yoga sometimes is combined with the word Jnana Yoga. Because that's where you're actually using your intelligence to divine things up. Well, not this, not... Yeah, yeah. So that's why it's confusing, because it's all the same thing. You know, Officer John Smith, you know, Daddy, you know, John, Johnny. It's a... 221-379-4438. It's all the same person, you know. But in different places, he had different names. You know, it was like, you know, he was his uniform on, an official position. His wife doesn't call him, you know, honey, you. Yeah, yeah.
Prabhu, but is it good to actually be intelligent to speculate something, or is it best to surrender to?
Okay.
Lord Krishna.
he says that we should okay, our Anya Abhi, this is the definition of bhakti. Goswami gives this very thing. Anya abhilasita shunyam. You know? Abhilas means desire, right? Abhilasita means motive. He has a little thing there. Jnana, karma, all these things. You know? Anya abhilasita shunyam, jnana karma adi, anavritam, not covered. You shouldn't become covered by these things. You know? Yeah. So your motive should not be to cover yourself by these things. Okay, so therefore we engage in jnana, right? Jnana means analysis. Jnana means grammar. Jnana means algebra. Jnana means, you know, Euclidean geometry, categorizing things. You know, this is jnana. Okay, so that this shouldn't be your motive. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, we can use these things to in Krishna's service. And that's the whole thing. We should be in, you know. And you should use it as much as necessary. Radharani refuses to grow. Radharani refuses to know. It's like, you know, Mother Yashoda does not know that Krishna is running out at night playing around with the girls, you know, like that. He just doesn't want to know about this. You know, my boy is a good boy. I wouldn't do that, you know. And so it's like that. It's just, even in Goloka, there's knowledge, you know, science knowledge is first. It's our whole culture. Just know, you know. But then we say, well, no, there's a certain motive. You know, what is your motive? Make your certain decisions. You know, whether you're going to give these guys the atom bomb or not. You know, your scientists are responsible because, you know, they gave the military the atom bomb. They could have said, no, these guys are not proper. We shouldn't give these guys this. You know, so there's certain. That's why our show tonight will discuss this. Yeah, but that's our point. Is that first is love, you know, motive, and after that comes knowledge. You know, yeah. So we're not in favor of After the atom bomb went off and radar was discovered and all these things, historians say at that point science just became so powerful. And the only rule is whatever science can do, science must do. What was right or wrong, it doesn't matter. If we can just do it. And so it was unintelligent absorption in Shakti, you know, without consideration. So then, yeah, jnana is... Especially in the beginning stages like this, jnana is very important, you know, to guide ourselves because we haven't got purified sentiments. Yeah. So 3:30, it's very interesting. Krishna says, do it for me. Because Arjuna is confused, you know. So then my summary, you know, as I know this, Arjuna is confused. And it's this basic point, you know, of jnana, of Sankhya jnana on one side and karma yoga on the other side, you know. And so then, please tell me clearly what's going on like that. So then Krishna gives a very practical explanation. All living beings subsist on food grains. Food grains come from rain. Rain comes from sacrifice. Sacrifice comes from prescribed duty, dharma, kshatriya karma. And this is described in the Vedas. Therefore, everything is in the Vedas like that. You know? So, and then he tells him, and so, you know, do your karma, you know, demigods, everything else, but he comes back down to a very clear point, do your karma for me. Do your kshatriya duty for me. Like that. Is there anything else in the chapter? What else in that? That's about all I know. I don't know. I don't know Bhagavad Gita that well. Yes, yeah.
Maharaj, in chapter 3, the last few verses.
Yeah? Oh, yeah.
They all talk about lust.
Yeah, yeah.
And based on the purports, Prabhupada explains that it is lust for women. But Arjuna doesn't seem to be so lusty. Why did Lord Krishna delve on lust in this chapter at this point?
No, because that's Arjuna's whole motivation. See, gross sense gratification is not lust, it's ignorance. You know, in that sense. Not passion, it's ignorance. And when you're thinking about it, contemplating it, you know, that's the mode of passion, when the desires are there. Mode of passion is to dress up very nicely and go with your wife and children to the plaza on Saturday night and walk around and buy ice cream and, you know, talk to the mayor and, you know, that's honor, prestige, civilized life, you know, respect. Then gross sense gratification is in the mode of ignorance with the senses involved like that. So planning about it is in the mode of passion, doing it in the mode of ignorance like that. And then that enjoying perspective is in the mode of goodness, you know. Like that, just like that. So Arjuna, in the beginning, he's he's contaminated by lust. You know, when the game of dice was over, right? Draupadi was saved by Krishna. They're all walking out. They got some honor back. And she undoes her hair like that, you know. And Yudhishthira says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm a widow. If I had a real man for a husband, he would have protected me." Like that, you know. So these are Kshatriyas too. You know, real man, you know. So they want to go back and kill them all, and you know. And she refuses to do her hair up. She lies on the ground. So she's using her. Actually, as far as I understand it, Duryodhana was not only afraid of the Pandavas. In the end, he knew they would forgive him and everything else. He was afraid of Draupadi. And he knew that she was not going to give up until he was dead, like that. In the Peter Brooks movie, it's really, really nice. Dushyanta, he's the one who drug her in. A very terrible situation. You described it as horrible, horrible. You know? And so then Bhima swore, what? Dushyanta, he said what? Yeah, I'll rip your heart open and drink your blood. So the Peter Brooks movie, he had them run around the stage, I think maybe 10 times, and they were actually breathing, panting. Okay, now, film it. You know, and they have gravel on their faces and scratches and... Bhima's a big guy from Jamaica. My God. So they're fighting, and Draupadi runs in, and she's watching this whole thing, and Dushyanta almost kills Bhima, and then Bhima rolls him over the last minute and kills him and pulls his heart out, and he looks up at the camera and said, "There's nothing as sweet as the blood of my enemy." And he turns to Draupadi and he says, "Draupadi." because she's the cause of the whole thing, you know. It's a big test. There's no smaller test for girls, you know. So at that point, she could just run away and say, "Oh, I never wanted this." You go to hell. Yeah. So a very big moment, you know. So she drops on her knees, flips her hair over into the blood, and ties it up. You know, yeah. So it's on my head what you did. I take it, yeah. So very intense, you know, dharma, karma for everybody like that. You know, and trying to sort it all out is a whole difficult thing. You know? So the point is here, as Krishna's saying, you know, just do it for me. Because in the beginning, he's trying to do it for Draupadi. And it's not gross. He wants that his wife, when he goes home at the end of the day, he drops all the crowns at her feet and says, "Your enemies are defeated." And she ties her hair up and says, "Thank you, Arjuna." Like that, okay. You know, it's very gratifying. You know, a man wants to satisfy his wife, and you know, it's the mode of passion. Prabhupada says it's not spiritual. Prabhupada says that grihastha ashram means to decorate the body, decorate the house. It's not spiritual, but at least it's civilized like that. And gross enjoyment is like animals like that. You know, so in the beginning, yeah, he is lusty. You know, but in that sense, yeah, we think of something more gross. You know. Yeah. And the way Krishna is describing it is that one thing leads to another. Yeah. This is common for me. This is almost like an extra added, something Krishna tosses on at the end, just to like, you know, extra 5% for free, like that. Any other points about this third chapter? Yeah.
There's also another point that once this enemy of knowledge and self-realization is invoked, which is lust, then Krishna tells Arjun how it can be controlled. He says you need to regulate your senses. And then he even gives a formula for doing that. And that is become situated in Krishna consciousness, develop that steady intelligence, think about me, and gradually you'll be able to mitigate that lust, which takes us to that last verse, which is the key verse of chapter 3, 343, I believe.
Yeah, 341. Curb his enemy by regulating the senses and destroy of knowledge of realization. Yeah, higher than. Yeah, thus knowing oneself to be transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, Almighty Arjuna, one becomes steady. One should steady the mind by deliberate spiritual intelligence, thus by spiritual strength conquer. So what is the Sanskrit for steady spiritual intelligence? Evam buddhi, evam buddha, buddhahe, param buddhva. Thus, to intelligence superior, knowing, stabhyam, be steady, atmanam, atmanam, atmana. Wow. If you didn't have Prabhupada's translation and purport, this would be completely confusing. You know. But that's why, again, is this the author of Vyasadeva, if you can't get too specific yet, because people are just, they're afraid of like personal reality. So he's talking very general. So in Bhagavad Gita's Upanishad, Atma, Atmavan, it's more clear than any other Upanishad, but the general thing is it's just like, you know, be intelligent, think of the self. Again, they ask Buddha. Yeah, Buddha. Some people say there's a God, some people say there's a soul, and some people say there isn't. What do you say, Buddha? That it was a heavy, big, all the old people's watching, big conflict, you know. Then Buddha says, you should find out. And because Buddha didn't talk about these things. That's the whole point. You know, they say Buddha says there's no soul. The second sermon is that there is no soul sermon. Buddha never says that one time in the entire sermon. He just says that the senses are not real, this is not real, but he never denies the existence of the soul. Yeah, his followers, some people wanted to do that, but very, most of them don't. You know? Yeah. So that is, you know, Atma, 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 Mavan, be fixed, and probably says Krishna consciousness. Yeah. Yeah.
But Buddha had also, during his time, said,
the Vedas are not the answer to everything.
Yeah.
Isn't that he was asking people to, as such, put Vedas aside?
Looking at what the historians say, as far as I know and everything else, everybody agrees that nobody has the primitive teachings of Buddha. You know, everybody's got something which has come from some degree of, like, you know, change like that. But basically, what we say, which I guess pretty, you know, authoritative, is that Buddha said that. And what he's saying was, Buddha says, if the Vedas say you can kill animals and this kind of stuff, then I don't believe in the Vedas. You know, so again, it was like, you look at it as, you know, he didn't say it, but he says, if the Vedas say this, then, like that, you know. Yeah.
That's an exceedingly good point, Mark.
Yeah.
Because in terms of the transition from various yugas, we are where we are.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this present state of affairs,
yeah.
And therefore, we cannot accomplish what the mantras accomplished in the previous
years. Yeah.
So that it was not animal slaughter.
Yeah.
If we continue to do these things just because we think they should be done.
Yeah.
They're very ineffective and very harmful.
Exactly.
And therefore, that's why it had to be stopped.
Yeah. There's other. Yep. That's it. Yeah. And then Buddha stopped it in the Orient, and then other people stopped it in Israel. Yeah. So anything else in chapter 3? You've got to go ahead here, I think.
Maharaj, one point is that there was a question of why lust came up here.
Yeah.
The Acharyas have described that, you know, Krishna is saying you do all this duty and everything. Then Arjuna says, why then people act like, you know, so against religious principles which you are talking right now? What is the cause for that?
Yeah. So many times in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna asks questions not for himself, you know, but for so everybody else can understand like that. He kind of realizes that this is not my problem. I'm being put in the situation by Krishna, and you know, now I should, you know, do from a broader perspective. Yeah, that's important for understanding Bhagavad Gita. Many times it's just Arjuna's asking for everybody else's benefit. So then, chapter 4 is where I see. Is that Mayi Sarvani Karmani? So, chapter 4, Krishna, for the first time, distinguishes himself from being an ordinary soul or even being a self realized soul. Because I'm saying this now, like I get my link. Because before he says, you know, you have to do your duty, do your karma, but if you're self realized, probably Atmastita or something, then you don't have to do these duties. But kings like Janak and others, they did this just to set an example for other people. And I also am doing this to set an example for others, because if I don't do this, the whole world will go to hell. Yum, yum, vapi. It's going to be on the test. It's a very important verse. Yeah. People ask me, how can I educate my children? How can I do this and that? First thing is, most people, you know, Brahmanas and Kshatriyas to some degree can understand by intelligence. But, you know, Kshatriyas to a large degree and Vaishyas and Shudras, you know, need an example. They follow the example like that. You know? Parthasarathi, our soldier guy, he said, soldiers, you give him one objective. Say, okay, you know, men, we're going to take that hill. You know? Now, if you give him two objectives, it's starting to get risky. If you give him three, it's a guaranteed failure. You know? You're gonna, you know, tell him, we're going to, you know, yes, sir, take that hill. And it's just, because they're Kshatriyas. Their thing is not intelligence. Their thing is bravery, right? And accomplish the goal like that, you know? And that's good. Okay, Prabhu, today we're going to distribute 7,000 books. 7,000 books. How many left? 800. What time is it? 7 o'clock. Stand back. Yeah. Yeah. Broken arms, everything else. As I said, they come back, broken arms, everything else. So he said that. You know, two goals, okay. You're starting to have problems. You know? So this is, you know, Arjuna many times asking those questions, but here in chapter 4, for the first time, I think Krishna is really, you know, really distinguishes himself as being different than the self-realized soul. And how does he distinguish himself? What does he say about himself? He says where the knowledge comes from, coming from the sun god. He's going to tell us about that. It's nice. It's not, the parampara is nice, very important. But then Arjuna asks a question. What's it? Huh?
How does he says he's. So he says a sun god is senior by birth to you. So how am I supposed to believe? Yeah. So Lord Krishna says he remembers many past births, unlike Arjuna.
But that can also be the self-realized soul, like Janak. He flows through many lifetimes. So it's another verse, right after that, huh? That's what I think. Yeah, Ajopi San Abhyayatma. What is that? Text number what? Yeah, 6, 4, 6. Yeah. Although I am unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and although I am the Lord of all living entities, okay, that's different. And still I appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. So that's, I think, the one where Bhutanam Ishvaropi Sam. That's really pivotal, like that. That's pretty heavy. Bhutanam. Well, that's because he's the impersonal Brahman. Yeah. He's the impersonal Brahman, and therefore he's the source of everything. Yeah. Bhagavad Gita is very personal. You know, it's really hard to get an impersonal meaning out of it. You know, Krishna's talking to Arjuna, you know, very, you know. But he doesn't mean me, he means the impersonal Brahman within me, like that, you know. So any other, yeah. Huh? Yeah.
So, like, this Prakriti refers to Devi Prakriti or, like, Durga, like,
well, Prabhupada says in transcendental form in the purport, and word by word, Prabhupada says. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sambhavami Abhaya. Prakritim Swamadhisthayam. That's established in my own prakriti. Para prakriti, apara prakriti.
Well, some people say, like, when God incarnates, he takes material from the body and, like, all that.
Yeah.
They can also translate this as, prakriti itself means, like, this.
I mean you see, there's all kinds of translations of Bhagavad Gita and stuff. You know. That's why Prabhupada, you know, is explaining it in a certain way, making it obvious. In some ways, Prabhupada is not concerned with fighting with scholars, with jnani. This is not the age for jnan. So Prabhupada is not so concerned with that. He's looking for people who are basically bhaktas, who already appreciated this, and giving them the proper, you know, intelligence presentation. And somebody then who's basically intelligent will look at it and say, yeah, that's right, you know. Yeah. And the conclusion is right. Yeah, okay, yeah, I got, yeah. So we're not really looking for intense, long arguments in the gyan level. You can do that, you know, but different people, but that's not this age. And so sometimes you see for hours and hours and hours you can argue about these things intellectually and nobody really comes to a, you know, especially the person does not want to know, you know. Yeah.
Maharaj, that's such a wonderful point. It deserves to be stressed. All right.
See,
we are, of course,
caught up in the age of affluence and knowledge.
Yeah.
And so naturally, we want to read lots and lots and lots of books.
Yeah.
And lots and lots and lots of commentaries.
Yeah.
And in effect, we're really moving ourselves away, far and far and far away from the real heart and soul of the matter.
Unless that's your service.
Well, you know,
if
the point
your service is reading lots of books, okay.
Well, of course that's the case, and I didn't mean to say otherwise.
No, I know, but that's the
but
point.
I was making your exclamation point with another one.
Yeah.
And that was by saying, you're intelligent, you're here, read the right books, get out there and perform your duty, do your service, practice your yajna for this age, which is to chant your japa, and teach others to do sangatan, all right?
And
your
people.
Life will be successful.
And go kill people. Go kill people for... Yeah, that's the whole point.
Well, in this context, of course.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, there's a manual of service in any responsible
they didn't go on
arena.
They didn't
of
go
course.
On discussing for days and days.
But, you know, get out there and get busy with your service. But the reality is, do your service and keep yourself simple. Thank you.
Know as much as you need to know.
Yeah. It'll be revealed to you later. Yeah, don't get too caught away. How do you...
You may also have to say that this knowledge is important to impart or convey an understanding to people who may not have transcendental knowledge.
But then Clint Eastwood says, you know what Clint Eastwood said?
No.
He says, I don't talk much, but when I talk, my pistol talks for me. So, no, some people, that's just, some people are just, you know, they judge by, for example, a lot of ladies come here, they look and see how their children are being taken care of and how they're growing up. Finished, you know. There's this little philosophy, something like that. They get an idea, but they're looking and seeing, you know, okay, yeah, these are nice kids. They're growing up nice. This has got to be a good thing, you know. Some dog comes here, smell everything. Oh, nice place, you know. So different people, you know, approach Krishna from different ways. So we have to get enough gyan as appropriate to our particular body, mind, service. And, you know, some people are very simple. That's one problem in ISKCON is we tend to be an intellectual organization to a large degree. It probably says in the beginning you've got to be that way. But then we don't realize that a lot of people are not intelligent. It doesn't mean that they're not intelligent at heart, but let's see, a lot of people are not intellectual. You know, a lot of people are just, you know, they judge from the heart, like Kshatriyas, they judge from the stomach, like Vaishyas, you know. Yeah. One devotee said, I'm here because I got three hots and a cot. three hot meals and a place to sleep, you know. But then the heart, you feel something else. Yeah. That's the bhakti goes right to the heart, and you judge. You know, yeah.
At what stage does knowledge acquisition prevent a person from developing spontaneous love of Lord Krishna?
I don't think it's a stage. I mean, it's just a fact. You know, it's just it happens when it happens. You know. Abraham Lincoln said a man's legs should be long enough to reach the ground. A man's legs should be long enough to reach the ground. You know? So how much knowledge is enough? You know, when you can do your service. That's the whole... Ultimately, the thing is we go back to Guru, Acharya, and so we can see Prabhupada's standard and everything else like that. I mean, to say, yeah, we're getting too mental about this. You know, we need to... You know, many Bhakti Shastri programs are accomplished within 6 weeks, these retreats. And the almost universal result is that nobody wants to read the books after that for months. The teachers, the students say, it's just like... So that's too much knowledge, too fast. Our Bhakti Shastri program in Peru, we're taking 2 years. And you figure that's every day you read a little bit, you do your service, and you know, it goes in like that, whereas actually the knowledge is matching up with the actual practical things in life. But of course, again, some people, they're Brahmins, you know, so they're supposed to be intellectual. Other people are Kshatriyas. They're supposed to get a simple, practical idea, you know. And Vaishyas are supposed to just, you know, feel it, basically, you know. And Shudras, basically, they're supposed to just follow instructions. They should be able to distinguish people like that. And they should be able to get the intelligence from somebody else. They always ask questions like that. You know? So that's everybody's got their own position. You know? Achihara, right? You've already gone over that. Achihara prayasascha prajalpa niyamagraha. Text number 2, Upadeshan Rita. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says, acquiring too much knowledge is another form of achihara. Yeah. One thing here, we're going to... our mission today is to go... Preview chapter 4, Here's a couple more minutes for that. So what else is in chapter 4? Krishna, we'll come back. Krishna says, he reveals who he is, and then he talks about why he incarnates, like that, Sambhavi Bhavami Yuge Yuge. Yeah. What else, anything else here in chapter 4?
Maharaj, so Lord Krishna actually
chapter
speaks,
4, chapter
yes,
4.
Chapter
okay,
4.
Okay. Yeah, it's okay, yeah. No, chapter 4 she wants to do. Yeah, 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 okay.
So Lord Krishna actually states, he tells Arjuna that he wants to now distinguish what is the action for Krishna and what he is actually supposed to do. He said he would explain that to Krishna, to Arjuna. And in that process, he actually states, he makes a statement where he says that an intelligent man is the one who sees action in action mm-hmm. and inaction in action.
Yeah.
And I just thought if you could help us understand that phrase.
Yeah. Okay. All the way up to chapter, up to, all the way up to verse number, we're going to get to your question. Yeah. Up to text number 24. To me, basically, it seems like he's just going over karma yoga again. He's discussing karma, reactions, that kind of stuff. Then in verse number 24, then he starts talking about, you know, doing everything as sacrifice. Brahmarpanam, brahmaharvir, brahmaragnav, brahmahutam, brahmaiva tinagantavya, brahmakarma samadhinam. See, we're not giving to prema. We're still talking about liberation, brahma, brahman, you know, like that. So then after this, there'll be a long section talking about sacrifice. Sacrifice your breath. Sacrifice your possessions. Sacrifice your opinion about things. You know, sacrifice on and on. Then 434 is a very crucial verse, four principal verse. It says, Tad Vidi. What does that mean? Tad Vidi. What does Tad mean? Tad? Huh? Yeah, that knowledge. Because he's been talking about sacrifice, so that means that knowledge of sacrifice. Tavidi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam yaninas tatvadarshinaha. 434. Some people say the most important verse in Bhagavad Gita. Because this is where Arjuna, Krishna tells Arjuna how to get this knowledge. And how do we get it? Huh? Yeah, by approaching a person who has seen the truth. Have you seen the truth? I have. He's right there. Yeah. So different levels of having seen the truth, you know, like that. You know, yeah. So different levels of being a guru. You know, you can describe something. And how do you get it from him? Yeah, questions and service like that. Yeah. Because without the actual service, right? There's no stimulation to question properly. Like that. When there's service attitude, service, then you're asked, and the questions are coming, and the spiritual master can give the answers. He can't give them if you're coming to acquire knowledge to dominate the world or something like that. Service is a whole difference. In the next verse, 435, he says what that knowledge is. Once you've got that knowledge, you'll never be in delusion ever again. That knowledge is? What is this knowledge? Read the chapter, you'll find out. No, yeah? You know, all living beings are in me, and they are mine. Same as the Isopanishad, right? Same as the Isopanishad. Yeah. So 436, even, okay, now he's, many times Krishna gives the knowledge, he gives the result, he talks about if you don't follow it, what happens if you do follow it. And a lot of times it's glorifying the knowledge. The knowledge will be like one verse, and there'll be like eight or nine verses just kind of glorifying it. Api chet asipape bya. Even if you are the most sinful of sinful people, when you are situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge, which he's already given, you will be able to cross over the ocean of miseries as a blazing fire. So he's going to glorify the knowledge. Very nice glorification. Yeah. There's nothing so sublime and pure as transcendental knowledge, which is the title of this chapter. So he goes on, then he goes contrast. But the faithless and the ignorant, keep your questions there, write them down. But the ignorant and faithful who doubt. So many, many times it's back and forth, back and forth. Now the people who don't take this, who don't approach the spiritual master, who don't have a service attitude, who can't distinguish who's a guru and who's a fool, you know, what happens to them? They do not attain God consciousness. They fall down. There is no happiness in this world or the next. But, yeah, one who acts in devotional service, 41, renouncing the fruits, everything else, there's no reaction in this world. Therefore, yeah, tasmad agyana sambutam kritstam jnana sinatmana chitvaina sangsayam yoga atisto tista bharata. Therefore, the doubts that have arisen in your heart out of ignorance should be slashed with a weapon of knowledge. This whole chapter is transcendental knowledge. Yeah. Armed with yoga, O Bharata, stand and fight. Yeah. But still he hasn't given him the motive to fight exactly. You know, Krishna still hasn't said, I want you to fight, you know, exactly it seems. He said this, that. But now at some point Krishna says to say, I don't know if he ever says that in the Bhagavad Gita or not. You know. He says, do it. I want you. Prabhupada says that Hanuman, he wasn't very intelligent. Hanuman, he was a monkey, he was a gorilla, you know. He wasn't very intelligent, you know. He said, but he said, Ram and Lakshman, you know, he's talking to the rest of the gorillas. He said, Ram and Lakshman want this, and that's enough for me. Okay. So they were like that. It's not very intelligent. But then that was the order was there. The relationship was there. The bhava was there. It went beyond all knowledge, and all different doubts were removed. Right? All doubts were removed. And at that point, he knew that this, whatever, if Ram and Lakshman want it, it's for everybody's good. It's for everybody's welfare. So that goes beyond the Bhagavad Gita. So I don't know if Bhagavad Gita Krishna ever tells Arjuna, you know, do it for me. Okay, he says that. Mayi karmani sarvani. He starts to talk about who he is. So we did it. Chapter 4, finished. Okay, now we'll back up.
So even as he concludes chapter 4, he still makes the recurring theme stand and fight. He once again is emphasizing, pay attention to your prescribed duty. You are a kshatriya, you are a warrior.
Yeah.
You need to be out there on the battlefield.
Yeah.
So wouldn't that be, we are now also on karma yoga somewhat?
Yeah, yeah. As I say, it doesn't, he's kind of like, Bhagavad Gita is focusing on that level. It doesn't go to other higher. It goes to them a little bit, you know. It's like that. And our whole Bhakti Shastri program, we're trying to emphasize in this point that do your Bhakti Shastri program, but then later on, Bhakti Bhai Bhava, we're going to study these things again. If you want to understand Bhagavad Gita, then read Srimad Bhagavatam, because there you'll see Prabhupada using it again and again and again. In all these verses, you're kind of remembering, you see, and he's chanted a few times. He said, that's how Prabhupada uses it. Now I understand better. Two more people. You're third. Number three. Okay, yeah. And so we're going to go through this again and again like that, you know. So a lot of this, we're looking ahead. So Bhagavad Gita is coming back to this point. Prabhu, take out the trash. Like that. Prabhu, just come out, go out with the devotees on a book table and just stand there. Yeah. Well, just go with them and just stay there. Just do it. You know, okay, you know. Why? He explains some things like that, okay, but we're not ready for that. You know, Arjuna's, so this point is it's giving some jnana. Not much jnana. A little bit of jnana, focus, tasmat sarveshu kaleshu, mamanu smaram yujaja. Yeah, something. Some meditation on the Paramatma, the super soul. He knows everything, he's the oldest, you know. But that mostly, it's emphasizing this point that the connecting process here is through fruitive activities. And therefore it's called karma yoga. Yoga ruksha, yoga ruda, the verse. In the beginning it's called karma yoga. Different than karma. As you progress, it becomes, like now, jnana yoga, like that. And then you're doing everything, but now you're doing it with like intelligence and stuff like that. You know? Why are you out here on this book table? I said, because the whole world's based on literature. And And then you come to the level of focusing. You really narrow. Actually, that's when you start to know less. And dhyan, you start knowing less. When I was studying for karate, my instructor said that you usually reach your peak of your strength and your speed at brown belt. White belt, green belt, brown belt, black belt. He said usually you get your fastest and your strongest is about brown belt. He said, but then you start to slow down a little bit and use less force and start using a little more intelligence in the black belt. Stuff like that, you know. But usually, as you see, a brown belt is actually even more power, using more power and speed. but not winning as many fights. There's a guy like that. So that's what's happening. So dhyana, you start to say, hey, okay, now I think I haven't got to memorize, chant all these verses, memorize all this stuff. Let me just start focusing on some things and getting it better, getting it tighter. So I have my logic, and because guys ask these questions, I haven't got the answers. I got, oh God, yeah, my knowledge is not that good. Let me get my knowledge concentrated. So you go to dhyan, meditation. Now, Mataji had a question there. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Just a small interjection.
Okay.
Is that the lesser known fact is that His Holiness Hanumat Prakshak Swami Maharaj has a black belt in Okinawa karate.
Oh, I saw. My one time when I was about to qualify for my black belt, my instructor, Mr. Johnny Otter, he said, now, come here. I'm now going to tell you the most ancient and the most effective form of self-defense. And it's not kung fu. It's not man fu. It's run fu. So since then I have acquired a 22nd degree in yellow belt. So never forget that. This is coming from a very high-ranking karate expert. He who fights and runs away lives to fight another day. Yeah. Many, yes. That, yes, Ranjor. Okay. So how is there action and inaction? What's the verse number? Action and inaction.
17 and 18, actually.
Yeah. 4:17.
The verse is 18, where he says an intelligent man is one who sees action in inaction. Yeah. And
the intricacies, number 8, number 17. The intricacies of action are very hard to understand. Therefore, one should know properly what is action, what is forbidden action, and what is inaction. Number 18, 4:18. One who sees action in inaction and action in inaction is intelligent among men, and he is in the transcendental position, although engaged in all sorts of activities. A person acting in Krishna consciousness is naturally free from the bonds of karma, right? So you're acting, but you're not acting, because acting means reaction. That's the idea, yeah? His activities are all performed for Krishna. Therefore, he does not enjoy or suffer any of the effects of the work. Consequently, he is intelligent in society, even though he is engaged in all sorts of activities for Krishna. Akarma means without reaction to work. The impersonalists cease fruitive activities out of fear, so that the resultant action may not be a stumbling block on the path of self-realization. But the personalist knows rightly his position as eternal servant to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, he engages himself in the activities of Krishna consciousness. Because everything is done for Krishna, he enjoys only transcendental happiness in the discharge of his service. Those who are engaged in this process are known to be without desire for personal sense gratification. The sense of eternal servitorship to Krishna makes one immune to all sorts of reactionary elements of work. So that's the sense. Yeah. You're acting, yes, you know. And you should act. But the thing is, because it's for Krishna, there's no reaction in the material world. And devotee is not, you don't care. You know? I mean, you can go, Bhakti Noah Thakur says, if you can do your duty, right, and you don't care if anybody notices it, your whole life, that's self-realization. Right? What is self-realization? You do your duty, your service, and you don't care if anybody sees you, glorifies you, dislikes you, likes you. That's okay. That's self-realization. It's a very simple, very kind of interesting standard. Yeah. But that's what's happening. A devotee is doing everything for Krishna. You know, what do you get out of this? Somebody asked me that one time. I was walking back to Tulsi's house and the car stopped in front of me. Kind of friendly. It was Friday afternoon. Some kind of Mexican guys. Hey, what do you get out of that? You know, I said, I don't get anything out of it. This is Krishna gets something out of it, you know. And he was like, yeah. The mind wants to think, well, yeah, I'm good. No, I don't. Krishna gets the benefit out of this, right? So there's no reaction for me. I'm acting, but there's no reaction. Yeah. But and also Krishna. Krishna does not have to accept our service. Not that he reacts or Krishna reacts. He doesn't have to. Yeah. But he does, okay. And then there's a reaction. And that way the soul is self-satisfied. Our very nature is just serving Krishna, loving Krishna. Even if Krishna doesn't want my service, right? I still feel happy, you know? Well, why not? I'll get something else. Krishna is, so on. But it's, the gopis aren't acting, so, Krishna will be happy. Okay. There it is. Okay. Television. There you go. Just knock over the glass of water.
You're okay on that.
Today's your water day. Yeah. It's okay? Yeah. It's a Buddhist thing. Those who know do not speak, and those who speak do not know. You understand?
Maharaj?
Yeah.
So in the sense, the right action is the action.
Huh?
So the right action is the action which is performed in relation to Lord Krishna. And
or with Brahman, or with Atma. Here it's going to say, with Brahman. Your action should culminate in Brahman. But then Prabhupada says, with Krishna. Because the whole thing is when the puri puffs up, Krishna, maybe Krishna smiles. That's the whole thing. It's like, okay.
So that doesn't have a reaction.
Yeah.
Normally in our daily activities, there could be a lot of actions which we no matter how much we think, we cannot make it relate to Krishna.
That's because we're immature.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, at the beginning of Yisopanishad, Prabhupada says, Swayambhuvamanu in the beginning of Yisopanishad says, take your quota. And then Prabhupada in the purport gives a very simple, basic, 80% of the problem solved, 90% of the problem solved, and one simple thing about what is your quota. What is that? And we can't get them all, but we got 90% of the akarma done. So what is your quota? Prabhupada say in the purport to the first verse of Yisopanishad.
Your quota is what is set aside for you to maintain yourself and basic necessities. Other than that, everything else belongs to somebody else.
Okay, but Krishna is more practical, more simple. Vegetarian diet. Yeah, tiger's quota, meat. So we'll make it very simple. You stop killing animals, you stop eating meat, 90% of your quota problems are solved. George Harrison said the same thing. But after that, you should have to offer it to Krishna and everything else. But it's such a very simple thing. And so we can't satisfy everybody, can do so many things, but just by becoming vegetarian, we've done so much.
I was also to say that when the question comes up about one acting in the world doing everyday things, as to how is it connected to Krishna, that we are reminded of another verse in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, whatever you do, whatever you offer, do it as an offering to me.
Yeah.
So in that respect, if devotees are doing their daily chores, daily duties, by thinking about Krishna and dedicating it to them, then they would be essentially
no karma.
Yes, no karma, offering it to him.
Most of us work for money. Yeah, that's simple. We're all shudras. Okay, whatever. Or businessmen. So that's the whole thing. Is the money for Krishna? And you got to stop and think. You say, well, this is for Krishna, that's for Krishna. Ah, that's not for Krishna. That's for me. That's for this and that, So that's the whole meditation. If you're working for money, then you see, am I using the money for Krishna? 85%, okay. And Krishna will take care of the rest. But let me refine it. 90%, let me take care of this. So that the main thing in that answer is that for most of us is that you just are making sure that all the money is being used for Krishna. If you are working also at home, why are you working at home? To take care of the family. Otherwise, would we do that? Okay, so what's happening with the family? Okay, this boy is going to be a devotee. I'm helping him become it. This boy is going to become a demon. Okay, so I'll help him get into law school. And he can be like a lawyer, and you know, and that way he can be a, he'll he won't be a problem for society. He'll be a lawyer and stuff, and it's okay. You can be a demon. I'm saying it's very, you begin, you can make practical adjustments like that. And yeah, this is what I'm helping Krishna by not allowing people to become robbers and murderers. And so like that, we gradually go through our own life, and everybody has individual challenges. And one thing is 4:30 now,
yes,
so we should stop for our, or go to our
yes,
next program.
Yes, Maharaj.
Is this going to work?
Yeah.
It works? Slideshow works? Laptop? There is no slideshow. Dum-ba-dum-ba. We need a laptop, though. 1 second here. Hang on. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Can I make one closing remark?
Huh?
Can I make one closing remark?
Okay, a closing remark. Okay.
Everyone's special self-interest today.
Okay.
Make a decision, wherever you're at right now, whatever purpose is going on in your life, make a decision that you'll do it for Krishna and see the end result in a year from now. And those of you that just can't make that decision, do it for whatever reason you're doing it now, and see whether or not you're successful at this point a year from now. Thank you. Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Yeah. That's a fact. If we do it for Krishna, even Hansa Duda gave a nice example, probably from Prabhupada, that when you put a flower garland on your body, you don't have to put a flower garland on your shadow. So if you take care of your spiritual life, your material life is automatically adjusted. You know. So yeah. So actually we have, even I guess we got the PowerPoint show here. It's a very nice being here. I'm sorry, I would like to stay longer, but we're kind of being pushed to get to South America, but I thought, like, you know, a little bit of visit was nice. Yeah. Where's the PowerPoint? Well, it's not going to help you because there's like 700 files in the thing. How are you going to find the file? Huh? Tell you which one it is. Okay, I don't know myself. Yeah. I have to go back. I can load it. Yeah. Okay. Why don't you introduce the... Where's it going to be? Right here? Okay, we have a small break here, and we're then after a 40-second break, we're going to have a slideshow called Sir Isaac Newton, the Second Apple. And so don't go away, because after 500 years, the Second Apple is coming down, okay, here in Silicon Valley. Both the boys were taking homeschooling, and they went right to college directly without going through high school or anything else. And Radhika graduated from Boise State University, first place in philosophy and mathematics, you know. Then he went straight to Oxford and was one of the youngest people to graduate with his PhDs. And he's a Hare Krishna. Yeah. So there are great, great success stories. So his brother also went there, and he was studying science and religion. There's actually a doctorate program in science and religion. So I invited him to come to South America with us. We have a lot of good connections there. And what do I talk about? I said, why not this, Sir Isaac Newton, you know? Because people say Newton was a you know, theologian and everything else, and I didn't know about it. So you research it, and it turned out to be a very good topic. And we have, we've been preaching there a long time. You know, other people would have made a lot more advancement than we did, but we made some. So we had a nice connection with Concetech. Consejeros de Ciencia y Tecnología. And it's the National Science Academy. And they set the curriculum in science and technology from kindergarten to postgraduate. They dictate what people are going to learn. And also they distribute the money. So their curriculum has force. And we've done many programs with them, and they've actually been very pleased. You know, they say, honestly speaking, we don't let any other religious group come here. Catholics, anybody else, but you always have this very, you know, intellectual, scientific approach to things, and so it was very satisfying for us. So I mentioned Gopal Hari was coming with this presentation, and Victor Carranza, who's the second administrator, he says, okay, you should go to Cesar Vallejo University. It's our foremost science university. And we'll tell them you're coming and, you know, arrange for a program. The faculty there is our science faculty. And also there's students there receiving their prizes for best science projects of the year. So it'll be a very good audience. You know, the topmost students and high school students in science, the faculty. So we went there and we met the dean of the Department of Science. And he was a very roly-poly, rotund fellow and very friendly. And he studied at Sorbonne in France. Science. And he said, Victor told us you're coming, and I told all of our faculty and stuff they had come for this and stuff, but I don't understand exactly what's happening. And I said, well, this is Gopal Hari. He's finishing his doctorate in science and religion at Oxford. And he laughed and said, oh, science and religion, a zebra in pajamas. Let's go. You know, it's going to be something interesting. Science and religion. Okay, it's going to be interesting. So he went in, and all these professors of science, physics, everybody was there. And you could tell that a lot of them were like, you know, oh my God, okay, the higher administration said we got to come for some edifying, you know, hour of something. Okay, we got to do this. You know, oh, yeah. But within just a few minutes after he started making his presentation, everybody was like, you know, alert, awake. And finally, when we finished, one professor especially was talking about how nice it was and everything else. And then one of his students said, but professor, you're an agnostic. And he said, yes, I know, but this is very interesting, like that. So it was very good, you know, success. It basically, one of our programs before, Victor Carranza was talking to everybody. He said, this is a very strange thing to me, Hanuman Swami. I wondered about his presentation. But after hearing all this, I'm really convinced that you can be scientific and religious also. You know, for them. And Peru is a place where you can do this. Peru is a very, what's the word, mystical place, has many traditions. They say, los norteamericanos muchas veces son muy cuadráticos. Yeah. North Americans many times are blockheads, they put it like that, cuadráticos. Because, yeah. Here we are like that, we're very like that. But in Peru, no, they have more, much. They have to. Nature is right in their face with gigantic rivers and mountains and animals and tarantulas this big walking around in your, on your floor in your bedroom. But don't worry, at the last minute the rooster jumps in and saves you from the tarantula. Okay. Push it. Oh, you got it there. Oh, yeah, got it. Yeah, next problem is to find out which button to push. Function something or other, right? No, if F5 starts to show, we'll do it. Push F5. Just push S5. Push F5 and see what happens. You did it. I see. Right there. Okay. Okay. Now, whenever I say, Shivas, whenever I say, next, push the down button, I have a laser pointer I always carry with me, but I didn't bring it. Oh, my God. Okay. Okay. So here we go. Stand by. Newton and the second apple. Next. Okay. So we're going to examine, this is Gopal Hari's presentation. So we're going to examine three things in the presentation. It's okay. If it works, don't fix it. It's okay, it's close enough. The first rule of engineering is, if it works, don't fix it. Yeah. So it's close enough. Yeah. So we're going to examine three presentations. You can use this yourselves too, after this, okay. Update manager, updates available, please click, you know, okay, yeah, thank you, sir. Yeah. Scientific materialism, scientific creationism, natural theology, and the third one is going to be, what is Newton's natural theology? Next. Yeah. So right now, in the intellectual atmosphere of the world, the people who determine our future have a big debate going on in Oxford. Click. Yeah. And all these books are being published by scientists. For example, the atheists are revolting. God is not great. You know, the improbability of God, the God delusion, breaking the spell. So actually one of the biggest people is in the middle bottom there, which is Richard Dawkins. He's the lead biologist. He's the supreme biologist. You know him? Okay, he's a supreme biologist at Oxford. And he's one of the biggest proponents of this whole thing, the God delusion, everything else. So people call this, oh, thank you, you got one here? Okay, my God, I got a laser pointer. Yeah. Other way? Okay, yeah. Yeah, more or less, yeah. Mine's better. So people call this evangelical atheism. Evangelical atheism, like that. Because they're under pressure. Before they didn't care about the theists and everything else, but right now they're feeling a lot of heat, so they're starting to like all these books and everything else, you know. And so On the other hand, the theologians are actually coming up with very good arguments on the other side like that. If you look at it, he didn't mention this, the theologians there, they never had these arguments before. And where are they coming from? From Prabhupada. You see that the same arguments we make, because devotees have entered into this intellectual atmosphere in so many ways. We have a center, actually a very potent center in Oxford called the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies. Very potent. It's actually affiliated, formally affiliated with Oxford. And so our ideas are coming in. Prabhupada says that we don't care about the details or the structure. We care about the ideas. So now these ideas are entering in, and so then they have good arguments now about what is reality. And many younger scientists, I'll give the whole conclusion. The conclusion is that many younger scientists and everybody else are preaching for this point, that science is explains one part of reality. It's a very nice way, the best way to explain a certain aspect of reality. But it's not the way to explain everything. For that, there are other systems of knowledge. You know, okay, there are a poo-poo, who cares about them, give us all the money. No. And that we should know those systems very well. Our science should be very well integrated with the mature ethical ideas and moral responsibilities, a good study of the history of human nature. Our science should be well integrated with ontology and philosophy and these kind of things and religion. And so that's kind of like what is kind of shifting towards in the debate. And that's okay. That means the whole world will change a lot. Okay, next. So scientific materialism and all these books, what they present is that ontological claim, what is real, reality consists only of the things discoverable by science. That is, measurable, quantifiable. The epistemology is, how do we know? Science is the only legitimate path to knowledge. And this is their position, these scientific materialists. Next, Carl Sagan. The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. Next, Dawkins. The universe is that universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Some people say even the scientists are actually embarrassed by some of his arguments and stuff. You know? Yeah. Another one. Darwin made it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Okay. Steven Weinberg. The more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it also seems pointless. So these are ideas, you know. Leonard Lowitton. The problem is to get the public to reject irrational and supernatural explanations of the world, the demons that exist only in their imagination, and to accept the social intellectual apparatus, science, as the only begetter of truth. Okay, evangelical science. Here's the critiques. These claims in scientific materialism are mutually contradictory. They say only claims derived from science can be true, but that claim is not derived from science. Yeah? But as a philosophical presupposition or a belief expressing a form of faith and ultimate trust. Therefore, that claim violates materialism's own epistemological criteria. Einstein said the same thing. Many people have said the same thing. Einstein said science ultimately comes straight from the heart, all the work it takes, everything else. Ontological claim, what is real? Reality consists only of those things discoverable by science. Epistemological claim. This point was that he went through a review of the whole thing like that. You know, yeah. Science is the only legitimate path to knowledge. So this is pretty much many people have made this point. Science does not establish its own philosophical basis very well. It comes from some other point like that. Yeah. Yeah. Critiques. This doesn't necessarily mean that materialism's ontological claim is false. Right? It's an assumption, not a scientific conclusion, and needs to be recognized as such. So the point is that it's not we're saying that science is automatically useless or anything else, but it's not a found philosophical position. And so it may be true for a certain area, for doing things in a certain way and everything else. We're not saying that's not true like that. You know? But the idea that science is a complete philosophical system, everything else, and you have to accept its truth, that's fanaticism. scientific method, materialism is reductionistic. Okay. Takes a scientific methodological strategy. Oh, yeah. It takes a scientific methodological strategy and transforms it into epistemological, ontological claims. This is what happens if you go to Oxford. You start talking strange languages. So basically, it's the point I just made, that scientific has a way of looking things, a methodology of looking things, and they go beyond that to make it into an ultimate nature of reality and the ultimate way of knowing things like that. This methodological strategy is productive in scientific investigation, but not necessarily outside that context. Yes, sir. Okay, epistemology is how you know. Ontology is what you can know, and praxeology is what you do about it. Those are the three aspects of philosophy, many times like that. The hairdresser told me when I was having my hair fixed today that, you know, what's your name? You know, so it's just, or it smells like, looks like, epistemology. Many of our books begin like that, probably discusses it. Our epistemology is by hearing from an authority, ultimately. Albert Einstein. The scientific method can teach us nothing else beyond how facts are related to and conditioned by each other. Knowledge of what is does not open the door directly to knowledge of what should be. So science can tell us how to get an airplane across hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of open water with the Enola Gay. You may know this airplane, right? Yeah. Flying there at the end of World War II, across these water, navigation. And then it took them right to one within, 75 miles of one famous city, Hiroshima. Yeah. And then, pilot to Bombardier here, open the Bombay doors open, arm the instrument arm, push counter-check pushed, instrument is armed, okay. Now, 25 miles to target, if you were flying the airplane, I'm flying the airplane, locked on, this and that, 10, 9, 8, 7, 3, 2, 1, I'm not going to do it. What do you mean you're not going to do it? Go into a loop. Why? Because it's wrong. I mean, it's wrong. So science can tell us how to do things, but it can't tell us whether it's right or wrong. It tells us how things are, but it can't tell us how they should be. And that was a big discussion before in the Hiroshima. The scientists wanted, generally speaking, to drop the atom bomb off the shore and to show the Japanese what we had, where it wouldn't kill anybody, a lot of fish, you know. But the military said, no, we know these guys. You've got to hit them hard right in the face. And otherwise, they're going to adjust their mentality, and it will take years of people dying to invade that island. So finally, the military won. But it was a big moral discussion. So it's a very important point. Yeah. Okay, you got some more wireless there. Okay, next. Oh, it is next. Okay. Oh. This knowledge of objective truth, as such, is wonderful, but it is so little capable of acting as a guide that it cannot prove even the justification and the value of the aspiration toward that very knowledge of truth. He wasn't a good speaker. Here we face, therefore, the limit of purely rational conception of existence. So he's saying that the motivation for science does not come from a rational, detached view of reality. Science is full of passion and desire. And actually, Einstein also, but many people. This book is a very good book, Quantum Questions by Kim Wilber. It seems to be an extract of many famous scientists. He said, "What scientist works so pure and so hard for those moments when he sees the beauty in nature, the symmetries, the things like that." Yes, next. Okay, here we have scientific creationism. So we've seen scientific materialism. Matter is all there is. Science will explain everything. And there are problems with this. So science, what is natural theology on the opposite side? Okay, there's the koala bears. Whoop, whoop. Natural theology attempts to establish the truth about God through human reason and scientific observation of the natural world. So their idea is that we just look at the world and use your scientific intelligence and you'll establish that there is a God. The exact opposite conclusion. God's existence is derived from the apparent order, beauty, and wise arrangement of the universe. Okay, this is another philosophy. Okay, is she? smiling at you? Okay. So you look at that. Okay. So the point is that there's an artist, right? And nobody thinks it happened by chance, right? Yeah. It's the Mona Lisa. Okay, next one. One Porsche only. So this one? Was there also an artist for this one? Yeah. Well, who is it? Do you know? Any art critics here? Next. Boop. Yeah. One click. It's a landscape. Another click. By David Copenhagen. I think this is a famous one. People like that. Okay, next. Okay. Next. It's another landscape. Next. John Green. Okay, next. Okay, what about this? Is there an artist for this? What's his name? Yeah. This is a natural theological argument. If all these paintings and everything else are done by people, and we see so much beauty, symmetry, order, then there must be somebody who's doing this, you know? Yeah. Same way here. It's all happening by chance. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Richard Bentley. If one is going to counter the atheists, it must be through appeal neither to the Bible nor to teacher, but to nature. So this is the idea of natural theology. Next. David Hume, 1711-1776. I think he was a contemporary of Newton. Causal connections cannot be observed. So this is his critique of natural theology now. Example, day and night. Does day cause the night? No. So just because we see that within this world there is order and beauty and personal symmetry, that doesn't necessarily establish that was caused by a thing like that. So many times we see one thing follows from another, but there's no causal relationship. Another one. The world could be causeless. It could just all be happening this way. That's his argument. Arguments from design could lead to polytheism, many causes. Okay, so maybe, yeah, there is being caused, but there's many people. There's a god of the wind, a god of the sun, a god of the earth, like that. You know? These are very good critiques. The world does not point to a divine designer with infinite power and intelligence. Yeah? This is the argument. If there is a god, then why is there so much pain, suffering, stupidity, ignorance? And actually, that's kind of the opposite point that, you know, the scientific materialism. This is at the same time. Now, the odd thing is that Ramanujacharya, who lived apparently for 120 years, he had exactly the same arguments against natural theology. It cannot be established by reason that the intelligent cause is one and not many, whether an intelligent cause must be embodied or not, that the world requires a cause. An analogy between human creation and the world cannot be made. Like that, because the world is much more complicated, everything else like that, to just say, oh, we see this, we see that, you know. This is interesting because Ramanuja, who's also our Acharya, he's also saying, no, you cannot establish these things just by looking at the argument for design. Because many of the Christians now, in their attempts to establish creationism, that's what they call it. They're using the argument from this design like that. So Newton's contemporaries had objections. Ramanuja has objections. So we've seen two philosophies so far, scientific materialism and natural theology. And both of them had their critiques. So what is Newton's idea? There we go, Sir Isaac Newton, 1643 to 1927. So how long did he live? 50, pretty old, huh? 57, 77, 84 years? Okay, that's kind of one proof of his philosophy. The Principia Mathematica, published in 1687, is considered to be the most influential book in the history of science. Like that. I forgot exactly which slide shows follow like that. But I know at this point he also mentioned the fact that Newton, when he was still like even 17 years old, he graduated with his degree in natural philosophy or whatever it was. And his professor, who was the dean of science or whatever at Oxford, said, as long as Newton is alive, I cannot occupy this chair. So at 17 years old, he tried to make Newton the dean of the School of Philosophy. Everything that Newton did in science, he did within 4 years. From 17 years old to 21 years old, a little like longer. He discovered the laws of gravity, the laws of optics, the laws of mechanics. He invented calculus and so many other systems like that. Most people, if they did this in one lifetime, they get a Nobel Prize, even if they did one of these things. But he did everything within 4 years. And then he gave up like that. So he was, people say he was the greatest scientist who ever lived like that. Okay, what does he say about these things? Alexander Pope, he said, he was his contemporary, "Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light." He liked him, you know, Knighton, Newton. Okay, so why was he doing these things? Why was he investigating? And after that, he wrote so much theology. I think it's about 100,000 pages or something of theology in Latin. And it's never been published, available. And even consideration that it was because he was such a powerful theologian that it would have also established intense, you know, grounding in theology. Just now, I think, finally, some people are kind of pushing to have these things published and translated. He said in the Principia, "Nothing can rejoice me more than the fact that it, the Principia, should strengthen belief in God. God has two books, the book of his words and the book of his works." So he said two books. One is where God is, the Bible, and nature, where God is writing with his own hand. So his purpose in doing science was theology. He never considered himself anything other than a theologian from the very beginning to the end. But for some time he was interested in this thing of seeing gravity and the laws of mechanics. We see all the stars and everything else, but what's going on? So he investigated very carefully and he found such, you know, fine controls and laws and symphonies and harmonies and optics, what else? Mechanics, so many things. Some of his friends pushed him to engage in more scientific research, and he said, no, it's other people will do that. I'm really interested in something more important like that. Yeah. He said, "The most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being." So here he seems to present supporting natural theology. Yeah. But finally he says, "To reject the prophecies of Daniel is to reject the Christian religion. For this religion is founded upon his prophecy concerning the Messiah." So his final conclusion is the same thing, is you have to go back to Scripture. That was his conclusion. Other things can fortify us, they can give us the motivation to investigate, but in the end, aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate, 10.8 Bhagavad Gita, "Those who know I am the source of everything, they serve me." So the purport, Prabhupada says, you have to know the Scripture with the help of Guru and your own application. But the basis is Scripture, Veda, coming from God. So same thing he was saying, that you, in the end you have to go to the scriptural sources, the Bible, to get your real conviction like that. Yeah. And so A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, he's, you know, presenting the same idea, same propensity. This is what we did in South America. Same idea, same presentation of his Oriental culture and philosophy in the West and making it available. But we can see, you know, that it's not anything new. You know, such a great renown. Practically speaking, it's the greatest scientist to ever live. Newton was not a scientist. He was a theologian. And his conclusion in this modern argument that's going on right now, many people are taking this argument through design. Many people are taking scientific materialism. But in the end, you know, Prabhupada's saying, and Newton's also saying, you have to have descending knowledge. And Prabhupada says the Bible is authorized scripture. The Bible and Quran are authorized scripture like that. But he says that they're for a certain time, place, for certain people like that, you know, who weren't very elevated. Whereas the Vedas are for people who are vastly purified, intelligent. Carl Jung was talking to a bunch of scientists, and he said, "You think these ancient Chinese and Indian sages were a bunch of fools, you know?" So they weren't the fools. We are the fools. They were vastly intelligent. You know? And so they knew about Dian Shukla. They said, yeah, they knew all about all these things. There are batteries before Christ. There are descriptions of ionized hydrogen propulsion jets for making these things like that. But they were all considered kind of like toys, you know? They were not considered actually to be all that useful for a happy, natural life. And there were subtle forms of technology available to those people who needed them. Prabhupada says, yes, make television sets, maybe 20 or 30. and use it for something important. You know? Not that everybody should need a television set. No. Focus on these powers, maybe the kshatriyas or something. They have to have global communication. And there are different ways of doing this with crystals, with karate, pranayama. You know, so many descriptions and indications in the Vedas for very subtle technologies which would allow people to do these things, you know, travel on the Narada Muni travels on the airways. There are wind ropes holding the planets together. So if you read the fifth canto or the whole Bhagavatam, everything else, you find very subtle, you know, ways of manipulating energy in a very fine fashion. In Peru, people accept this because they still have a lot of contact with these very subtle sciences, with shaman. There's a very famous ghost house right in the middle of downtown Lima, next to the Sheraton Hotel, the tax office, you know, these big modern places. And on the bottom story, it's, you know, like one block. It's a typical place, you know, lunch counters for business office workers, magazine racks. The second story, all the windows are gutted out. There's nobody there. It's called Casa Matusita. And so some years ago, one reporter said, "We modern people don't believe in ghosts and these things. I'm going to spend one whole night there and nothing will happen." So next morning they went in and drug him out and took him to a mental hospital. He was completely gone like that. He finally recovered. You know? So I was talking about these things to some scientists in Peru, and some of them were kind of doubting about the Vedas because they've studied in Paris and Germany and the United States. And so I was kind of a little frustrated. So I said, "Okay, how many of you would spend one night in Casa Matusita?" You know, so all of them are going like smiling and going, you know, we may have our doubts about these things, but we're not fools. You know, we live in this environment. We see these things happening. So still in Peru, it's a very good place for preaching these things. If people have contact with these still kind of subtle things like that, very real reality. And so our point is that, you know, by looking at the Vedic description of nature, Sankhya, these kind of things, eventually, you know, you can come to Krishna and understand behind everything is motive. The mind creates the gross body, the gross world, and the soul, the Atma, with its desire, organizes the mind. So the ultimate thing is motivation. And there's a science for investigating that, and that's bhakti, bhakti yoga. And so down there we've had good results, you know, little by little. Like that, and introducing things like that. So, yeah. Come closer. Again, we are vegetarian. Do not worry. So, next is a conclusion. Next. Okay, thank you. Okay. Thank you all very much. So, any questions? Time for the arti, no? Oh my God, okay. Koi prashna hai? No? Yeah. Science and religion. Yeah. You? Yeah. Wow. There's no oxygen here. There's no oxygen in this room.
Since we are discussing about the subject of science,
yeah.
One question I have is, two questions. One is, in the description of... in the descriptions we find in Vedas, is solar system considered as a universe or the entire thing what we see is a universe? That's one question.
Okay.
The second question is, our scripture said there is only one sun per universe.
Yeah.
So how about you? You know, but there are many stars that we see,
yeah,
which are self-illuminating.
Yeah.
And how do you explain that?
Sariputta, Dr. Richard Thompson, of course, is one of the people who's done the most work in ISKCON on cosmology. Prabhupada said this is a scientific age. This is actually why Rupa Goswami even wrote, because of Navanyaya. So everybody's looking at that way, at epistemology, that, and it's had some results, and people are attracted. We're materialistic. And so then he probably started the Bhaktivedanta Institute to investigate these things like that. And it's had a whole history. Some people have focused on molecular evolution. Some people have focused on premolecular evolution. Some people have focused on different areas like that. But Sariputta did a lot of work in this whole thing of adjudicating the Vedic cosmology, the Puranic cosmology, with modern science. One of his first books was called, I think, Vedic Cosmology. and the later one was called the Mysteries of the Universe. So it's a DVD, which we have, and the book maybe out of print, you know. So many of the problems in there, for example, it says that in hierarchy, the sun is closest to the earth, then after that the moon, Mars, Martes, Miércoles. I can't do both. But Miércoles, Marque, Lunes, Martes. Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, like that. And that's the days of the week in Spanish, and it matches up exactly with the description given in the Vedas. The distance from the earth. So the sun is closer to the earth than the moon. Well, how stupid, yeah. So Sataputta goes through and it says Bhumandal, doesn't say the earth. So what it appears to be talking about is that you have the earth and all the planets, and you can have a geocentric model, or you can have a heliocentric model with the sun as the center or the earth, take your choice. You can also have a lunar-centric model. In terms of geometry, it doesn't make much difference, you know. But the Vedas are using predominantly a geocentric model. Well, why not? We live on the earth. Okay. So then, yeah, everything's going around the earth. You know? Of course, you know, if Mars is going around the sun, going around the earth, then what you're going to get are epicycloids, you know, where Mars will appear to go like this, you know, like that. So sometimes it'll be in retrograde motion. It'll go backwards and forwards like that. Yeah, but this is all, you know, in terms of geometry, this is all understandable. Okay. But now the strange thing is that when these things go around the Earth, they can go like this, and they could also go like this too, right? But they don't, you know. All of the orbits fall within a certain kind of plane like that. You can tilt them this way or that way, but they don't go like that, you know. So this dish is called the ecliptic, as I remember. So you look at the nighttime sky, all the orbits will fall within a certain distance like that. It's called the ecliptic. So if we take the distance above the ecliptic of the different orbits, basically the inclination of the orbit, the order of the inclination is sun, moon, Mars, Jupiter, like that. So what it's talking about, what the Vedas are trying to present, is that the distance of the orbits above the ecliptic, you know, falls in this order. Okay, but then Sataputta went back through and actually had a little laptop computer calculate the actual distance. There's some adjustments you have to make, which, okay, they're arbitrary, whatever. And it comes out that it's within 10 or 15%. It says, okay, it says 100 yojanas, 500 yojanas, 1,000,000 yojanas, 1,223 yojanas. But the actual difference compared to the Vedas and the actual calculation is only, the error is only like about 10% or something like that. So that's one thing. It's talking about Bhumandala as being one thing like that. As far as my understanding, the way Sataputta is talking about it, it's a whole thing. It's a whole different, because it's using a whole different energy thing and everything else for looking at this. Now, you've got to take the model and go into it from its own perspective to look at things. So usually the word jagat and universe, it appears to be, is talking about the solar system, like that. Now, nakshatra, the stars, how far away the stars, everything else, we're calculating certain distances, but there are many problems with that. You know, for example, the Crab Nebula or something is like, you know, 100 light years, 100 million light years away. Now, how far is that? How many miles is that? 100 million light years. Baba, the closest star is Alpha Centauri. Is like what? It's like three light years or something. You know, it's like, you know, that's a ridiculously long distance. So maybe somewhere along the line, you know, the light goes through a filter which changes it like this or does that or does something. You know, that's why not? It's so many strange things in nature. You know, so just that. That we're saying these things, Kenneth Boulding, he was president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, he said, I think we've known too little about the universe for too short of a period of time to say too much about it. William Stoger, he's a published astrophysicist, he's also a Jesuit priest, he said that if you sit on the earth and look at you know, look at the universe, and go all the way to Alpha Centauri, the closest star, which is, you know, a long way away. If you have that much of a range in your investigation, that's what science does. Look at things from a different, you know, over space. And also, if you have 10,000 years into the past and 10,000 years into the future to examine the universe, the change in the quality of your information from just sitting here right now with a camera and taking one picture will be, practically speaking, zero. Right? Okay, what's the universe? Okay, you know. Well, I'm going to look at it over 20,000 years before I make a decision. Well, I'm going to look at it from this angle. You know, that big of a difference and that big of a time give you absolutely no improvement in information like that. So that's the first point, is that science, this present scientific method, and not everybody, you know, but many people, the claims are coming in from this level about where are the stars, where are the galaxies, are they suns, are they universes? And the Bhagavatam is generally saying that they're all nakshatra. They're reflecting the energy of the sun. Okay. But so we're open to, like, in understanding these things. But basically, our point is that, you know, by investigation, we investigate Prabhupada, and see, this guy has no personal motive, you know, and he's presenting things as he's heard them, you know. And by following his process, I can also come to that process. I can come to a point where I'm free from my mind and senses, you know. And therefore, he said, this is what we've heard, and is coming back to a chain like that. So our epistemology is like that. But again, as far as I understand, you know, the basic idea is that, yeah, that when it talks about the universe, this universe is talking about what we would classify, in terms of our knowledge, mostly as being the solar system. And the distance of the stars away then is, you know, even the word yojana is a big argument over that. What is a yojana?
8 miles.
Eight miles, yeah. But you look in the Wikipedia, great source of knowledge, yeah. You go back, I'm wondering about this, it goes back and back and back. A yojana is based upon the width of one finger. Then so many fingers make this, and so many fingers, and finally you get, okay, at eight, you know. But Sukadeva Goswami is talking to Maharaj Pariksit at the end of the Dwapara Yuga. And right away the idea was, in their own internal thing, everything was much bigger and finer. That's the whole reason, like, it's a very important point. You know, Satya, Treta, Dwapara, Kali. Satya, Treta, Dwapara, Kali. Morning, noon, night. Morning, noon, night. You breathe in, breathe out. Lub, dub, lub, dub. Cycles. At the end of the Dwapara Yuga, things are much bigger in the first place. And also, he's not talking about things from the level of Bhumandala. He may very well be talking about them from the level of the Devatas. You know? So there are many, many, many things to adjudicate, you know, the Puranic stories. And not just us. Many other great scholars have gone through. And a lot of Sataputta's work comes from other people who made these investigations like that. So why do this? Well, because Newton says it gives us faith in to chant Hare Krishna and take prasadam. Yeah? But beyond that, yeah, there are many practical things that can come from this. Yeah? Many very practical things in terms of medicine, in terms of what? Astronomy, physics, Jyotish, you know, Yajurveda. So many things in the Vedas are described. What's the word? Architecture.
Vastu.
Yeah. I investigated Vastu to some degree. So much practical knowledge there. And because of Prabhupada, I've seen this personally. Because of Prabhupada, Indian universities are now investigating this. They won't know where it came from. But Prabhupada told Bhakti Sudhamana Maharaj. Bhakti Sudhamana Maharaj told me. I talked to Professor Samaresh Bandyopadhyaya, the Department of Ancient Indian History and Culture at Calcutta University. He talked to his department. They organized the first Indian conference on science and technology in ancient India. P.C. Chundar was there, you know, president of the West Bengal Science Association, everybody. It was nationally publicized. And other universities also started doing the same thing. And they said, oh, yeah, this is interesting. And many interesting things were discovered about science and technology in ancient India. You know? They didn't have high enough heat to produce steel. Well, no, Mohenjo-daro and Harappa, they were producing these little beads with metal mixed only as possible if you had high enough heat. Oh, well, okay. You know, so many nice, interesting things. So now that many other universities started taking it up, you ask them, well, what was your impetus to start this? Well, University of Calcutta started it. But of course, they did a very primitive effort, and now we're doing many advanced things like that. Where did they get it from? So if you investigate, you'll see that Srila Prabhupada is a big rock that's fallen in the water and is producing many waves. And that's one where I personally saw, like, you know, how it's come into the modern world. So now many Indian universities are doing research in science and technology in ancient India and discovering many interesting things. There are many very interesting things. Yeah.
Okay.
So what's your other, about the universe, as far as I know, that's it. And as far as I know, the suns, I don't know the, you know, well, how they're, because even reflection, it doesn't mean it has to be at an optical level. You know, radar also reflects, you know, like that, but it's not optical.
So any questions?
Yes, sir.
Hare Krishna. Regarding the gravitational force, like the Earth has the gravity, so that it is falling, I believe.
32 feet per second per second.
So, Prabhupada, in one of the morning work class, he mentioned that there is no gravity.
Yeah.
It's just the adjustment of the air.
Anantasesha, yeah.
And primarily because the leaf is falling from this one, and it is not because the Earth has the gravity, because it has the air adjustment, that's what it is coming. Can you elaborate on that?
No, because the word air in the Vedas, prana, usually it's the word prana is translated as air. And so it's not just Hare Krishna talk, it's all Vedic literature, all of Asian philosophy. So this is where my black belt, I was investigating this stuff, you know. So we were, because karate, you're starting to use prana, air, like that. So the Bhagavatam's explanation is that whatever you distinguish by heat and cold or hard and soft is prana, talking about. So like there's prana right here, but it's in balance. It's in balance like that. If you don't believe me, try and pull this thing apart. You know, this is tremendous a force. There's tremendous prana here, right? That's what the word air means, like that. The planets are held together by wind ropes, you know? So it's the whole thing of putting the proper language. We say gravity, but the Vedas say wind ropes.
Okay.
You know, Narada Muni travels on the airways. You know, when we were studying for this black belt, electric frying pan, with this big, you know. So you put sand in there, turn it on, and you pass your hand. You don't touch it, but you pass your hands right above it, like that. One time, like that. Okay. Okay. You know, and try again. Okay, then one and a half, you know. And you just practice, because the invisible air, prana, is coming up and trying to pull apart, you know, the prana that makes your hands, you know. So after a while, you begin to learn how to concentrate that, you know, like that, you know. And it's just practice. That's just no intelligence, no science. It's just a pragmatic thing, and you begin to feel it, you know, like that. So then at one point, I had a cat, and his name was Mr. Cat. he was black too, you know. So he was sitting like this in front of me. And so I passed my hand above him, maybe like about that much, you know, exuding prana. And I was practicing like that, you know. He turned around, grabbed my hand, and bit it. And he couldn't see me, you know. But cats are very sensitive to this. Their bodily structure, their bodily birth makes them very sensitive to tactile things like that. Yeah. So then I waited a couple of seconds and I tried it again. He turned around and bit my hand harder and ran away like that, you know. So he couldn't see it. You know, even the heat, I don't think, maybe was there. Well, the heat is also prana, you know. There are many, 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 many things like that you can go into. So it's just the whole thing. It's a shift, because we're so addicted to vision in the West, you know, very much addicted in industrialized society to vision. There are many studies in, you know, sociology and everything else. You go to the University of California before, say, the computer, how many references do you have on visual perception? 22,014. How many do you have in acoustical perception? 2,100. You know, so 10 times as many things about how to see things as there is to hear. But hearing is 10 times faster than seeing, and touch is 3 times faster. There's a hierarchy, you know. So then the prana is that which you can feel. You know, so like in your body, if you stop right now, you feel your body internally. How's your stomach? Feel good? Mine doesn't. A little nauseous, you know. Are there any point in your body right now where it itches? Is there? Where? Right here, a little tickling sensation here, the air like that, you know, the one here. Yeah. like that. Any place where it's kind of sore? I got a little sore throat. Yeah. So if you stop and think about it, your suffering is whole body, is itching, stuff like that. It's like, but we don't think about that because we're crippled in terms of touch. We're like third class people. We're always trying to see everything, you know, like that. You see my point? I understand. Yeah. The language actually reveals the whole. Very good person on this is Marshall McLuhan and E.T. Hall. Wonderful books on cross-cultural perception. There's another whole other PowerPoint show we do. But so that I was talking about then is air. It's not talking about this stuff, which is a kind of, it means prana. And whatever you can feel, whatever is hard or soft, whatever is hot or cold, that's prana, like that. And when it slows down or whatever you want to call it, manifests because of the time factor, then it develops color. So there's colorless prana. And then finally there's weightless prana. So then however it works, I don't know exactly, but then there are gravity. Prabhupada calls it the force of anantasesha. But there is like, yeah, we accept that. There's like, but it's air, you know. And again, what is up, what is down? Oh my God, you know. When I was a little child, you know, my brother was digging in the garden to plant some seeds, you know, but he was digging kind of deep, and I was afraid the devil was going to come out like that. The devil's down there, right? You know, and God's up there. You know, so what is down and what is up, right? You know, do you have people who are above you in the office? Yeah, are they above you? No, physically not. Yeah, but they're above you in that hierarchy. So again, the whole Vedas, we're talking about, for example, the whole earth, Bhumahandal, is above the Garbhadak ocean. Okay, that means we're going to look off and see it down there, you know. But above, below, different levels of, not we're talking about our visual perception and stuff. When the whole earth was submerged in the Garbhadak ocean because of Hiranyakasipu and Hiranyaksha, because they were mining too much oil and disturbing the atmosphere, you know, nothing new. Maybe sunk into a low level of existence and consciousness, like that. Yeah, it's okay. The Vedas. Now it's time. Okay, finally. So, Prabhupada ki, Hare Krishna Mantra ki, Mahaprasadam ki. Thank you, brother.